Are we prepared to hear argument in United States versus Rachel?
Good morning, and thank you for hearing this case. Unfortunately, it's not as exciting as the one down the hallway, apparently, but we'll try to make it as exciting as
possible. Well, every case means a great deal to the parties involved in it.
The court is aware that we presented two basic issues to the court, although there are many sub-issues. The first issue we presented in our briefs is the question of the attorney's fees and costs award to Mrs. Rachel, and the second issue is the substantive liability of RGI, Mr. Rachel, and CSM. And I'm not going to try to focus on everything we briefed. I think the briefs really do focus the court on the issues. I'm going to try to hit on certain important aspects of it, and I'm going to address the substantive issues first.
What was just point of information? How much was the award of damages worth?
The amount?
Yeah.
I believe it was $1.2 million. I don't have that number in front of me, but it was an amount, and it was trebled.
Okay. So it was trebled.
Yes, it was trebled under the False Claims Act.
Right.
And the award again was only against RGI, Mr. Rachel, and CSM. The jury returned a verdict in favor of Mrs. Rachel. Which is why we've asked for EAJA fees and for Mrs. Rachel. But again, I wanted to focus first on the substantive issues affecting RGI, CSM, and Mr. Rachel. The case against them rose and fall as a False Claims Act. There are a couple subsidiary issues dealing with common law, mistake of fact, and unjust enrichment. But if the False Claims Act case goes away, those claims fell as well. So I'd like to focus on the FCA claim. This court is aware that FCA liability requires proof of fraud, not just proof of a bad business decision or proof of a business disagreement or proof of a contractual question and ambiguity or even a violation of federal procurement law. None of those constitutes FCA fraud. In order for there to be FCA fraud, there's got to be a false statement made to the government who relied on that false statement to pay money to the person making the false statement.
Was the jury instructed along the lines that you just mentioned?
The jury was told there had to be an intentional misstatement to the government. But the jury wasn't instructed how to define intent as this court has defined intent in Kellogg, Brown, and Root in the KBR case.
Did you object to the instruction?
Absolutely, we objected, and the court...
Did the instructions cover the elements of the cause of action?
The instructions cover the elements of the cause of action, except it never defined what intent was, a la KBR, as this court has defined it. The KBR instruction, the instruction we asked for, and we begged the court to give, was a quote, direct quote from the KBR case, which I think was just Judge Wilkinson's opinion. And essentially what it said is exactly what I just said. Business disputes over business issues, disputes over contract issues, disputes over regulatory issues does not constitute intentional fraud. That's the instruction, in essence. We've given you the instruction, but that was the essential instruction.
But, an appellate opinion is often very useful with respect to instruction. But when we write appellate opinions, we're not attempting to write pattern jury instructions. And very often in our cases, we say that courts can instruct at a rather general level and leave the specifics of it to counsel to argue back and forth in front of the jury, and it was perfectly open to you to say that this wasn't intentional, it was a business decision, and the instructions require something that's a knowing statement of a falsehood, not just bad business. But we don't necessarily require instructions to get down in the weeds or comment on every fact or every wrinkle in the law or what have you. As long as they accurately state what the case is and submit it to the jury and give lawyers an opportunity to go at it with their respective theories of the case.
Well. That's I understand that. The problem here, though, is that this case never should have gone to the jury because the judge should have struck it on a motion for judgment, but instead he let it go to the jury and didn't tell the jury what the actual standard was, which was the standard set forth in KBR.
What was Mrs. Rachel's argument to the jury on this point? That she'd made no statement, made no representation, or was not intentional?
Mrs. Rachel?
Yes.
Mrs. Rachel's argument to the jury was simply, I wasn't there. I have nothing to do with this. I'm a nurse. I work full-time
So then it would have been that she made no statement. I'm trying to find out if Mrs. Rachel tried to draw a distinction on intentional statement.
No, Mrs. Rachel's position was she wasn't there at all. I mean, and the facts were clear that she had nothing
she
to...
Did she sign? I know she signed. Did she not sign some documents as a corporate executive, as the president?
No, Mr. Rachel signed her name on those documents.
Well, could the jury have believed she signed them?
No, there was no evidence that she signed them. There was questions from counsel for the government. Isn't it a fact that you signed this? Answer,
but
no.
Well, let me say this much. Her signature was on that page, wasn't it?
Her signature was on the page. So, and Mr. Rachel testified, I signed those pages.
You say she had nothing to do with it, but she served on the board of directors of RGI. She was identified as an officer. She was identified as a director. She, in response to the colloquy between you and Judge Shedd, a jury could have believed she allowed her husband to use her name to conduct business for her. I thought you were very fortunate to get verdict that she did, given the fact that she was an officer and director and could well have known that her husband was using her name to conduct the business affairs of RGI. And she wrote a lot of checks from the CSM account for her personal expenses.
She wrote no checks, Your Honor. There was not a single bit of evidence. There was questions from the government accusing her of writing checks, but there was no evidence that she wrote a single check.
All right, but that's a close jury question, isn't it? I mean, all of this is a jury question.
No, that's where I disagree respectfully with you. Even if she knew that her husband was using her name, that does not constitute FCA liability. I may know that somebody else is committing fraud, but unless I'm committing the fraud or unless I'm conspiring with that person to commit fraud, I'm not liable under the FCA. So the only thing the government could
this
prove...
This may not be a critical point, but I want to go back to... You're telling me as a matter of law the jury cannot believe that her signature on that document was her signature?
No, because there was no evidence that it was.
Well, it was her signature, though. Was there any testimony that didn't match her signature or didn't look anything like her signature?
Yeah. As a matter of fact.
What did the government say about that signature? Did the government argue that at all? I don't want to take too much time, but it strikes me if you present an officer's signature on a piece of paper, that even though someone else says, I signed that the jury could disbelieve the testimony that the second party signed it.
Well,
it seems to me they could. Well, maybe you know something about the law that I don't.
Mr. Rachel said, I signed it. Mrs. Rachel said, I didn't sign it. I wasn't even there.
That didn't settle. I don't think that settles the issue for the jury.
Well, can a jury...
If it's her signature on the line, was there any testimony about her signature on anything else?
It's her name, not her signature. Her name appeared there, but not her signature appeared there. And in fact, the jury saw Mr. Rachel in front of the jury, took a piece of paper and signed her name, and it matched exactly.
Well, the jury could have believed that it did so with her permission. The point is we review these EAJA applications under an abuse of discretion standard. And we don't casually reverse district judges on attorney's fees determinations of this sort. And, you know, the district judge here sat through the entire trial. And, you know, he's probably in a much better position than the three of us are to understand whether the government's case was just thin and weak, or whether it was substantially justified. But he had a vantage point on this trial that the three of us lacked, and we're up here on an abuse of discretion standard, and we're up here on an attorney's fee question, all of which is just a whole lot of different factors which counsel a certain degree of respect for that ruling.
Again, the question with respect to the EAJA fees is not whether Mrs. Rachel existed in this world of what Mr. Rachel was doing. but she can only have been sued under the FCA if she participated. And the only
officer and director of a very closely held corporation with where she, you know, that she is, they are spouses. She is an officer and director of a very closely held corporation, which her husband is also running. It's not far-fetched to think that she knew exactly what was going on. At least that's a credible jury question.
Let's assume she knew what Mr. Rachel was doing. It's still not FCA fraud. Even if she knew that her husband was out there defrauding the government, it's not FCA fraud for Mrs. Rachel to know that.
Well, if
now,
her signature was being used with her knowledge, it would.
Not if she didn't participate. And the evidence was clear that she didn't know specifically what documents her husband was signing. She just knew her husband was signing documents. That's all. She had no idea what documents. Her husband also put their son's name on documents. He could have put their dog's name on documents. That doesn't make them liable. It simply says that everybody knows that this is the way Mr. Rachel was conducting
business. In the initial appeal in this case, did you ask that summary judgment be entered on her behalf against liability?
Yes, we did.
Were you successful?
No, we didn't. We did not get summary judgment.
And it didn't the court indicate at that point, although taking all the information light most favorable to her, not that she defeated summary judgment on behalf of the government, correct? But did the court have in front of her question that she should win on those facts? She didn't win on those facts, did she? Doesn't that indicate there's a jury question based on the court's review of the facts?
Well, at that point in time, based upon the paper created at that point in time, but by the time we got to trial, the documentation and the depositions were absolutely clear. Let me step back a second.
Sure.
At the time that this complaint was brought against Mrs. Rachel, there was no evidence that she participated in anything. Nothing.
So then you would have won summary judgment?
Well, perhaps we should have won summary judgment.
But I understand it's your argument that you should have, but this court did not grant you that relief.
I believe what this court said is that it's not going to, at this point in time, on the appellate level, grant summary judgment. My reading of the court's decision, and I was standing in court that day, was this court was very close to granting summary judgment in that particular case. But it basically said, we'll send it back to the district
court.
Well,
I may have been on that panel.
I believe you were on that panel. I remember.
Sure I was, and I've not been as close as you think.
But
I'm just saying, I'm just looking at whatever we think about what happened. I'm just looking at the order, and although this is from that order, or closely from it.
Although
we are not prepared to rule as a matter of law that the appellant cannot be held liable. So I think that answers.
Actually, when the case was brought, there were a bunch of her signatures on a bunch of checks at that time that she had yet to deny. Isn't that right? When the case was brought, not after the depositions, when the claim was brought by the government, her name was signed on a lot of checks and a lot of corporate documents. Isn't that right?
That is correct. But
her signature was notarized on the Articles of Incorporation, right?
That is correct.
But at the time it was brought.
That is correct. But what doesn't appear in the record, because it wasn't relevant as an evidentiary matter, was that at the time the government brought the case, this was not the first runaround with RGI. They had gone through this several times, and the government knew that Mrs. Rachel's involvement was zero. She was just there in name only. And in fact, what it had done is disbarred RGI, and then as a basis for allowing RGI to continue doing government contracting business, it permitted Mrs. Rachel, and this was in the record, it permitted Mrs. Rachel to take over RGI as the president and owner. In other words, Mr. Rachel gave up his ownership interest and gave up his position and turned it over to his wife. And the court said, the government said, because you're not involved, because you weren't involved before, we're going to let you, your claim, we're going to let you run the company.
All right.
So,
you've got rebuttal time.
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for having me today. I would respectfully agree with Judge Wilkerson. I don't believe that the matter with respect to Mrs. Rachel was close. It was a fortunate event that I think she was not found liable here, and it's not even close in terms of considering the reversal on an abuse of discretion standard as to Judge Nickerson's finding, who sat through the trial.
You have four other defendants that were found liable.
Three others, yes.
And certainly she's tied in with them in various formal capacities, and given the fact that you have four that were found liable, and she is not exactly disassociated from them, it's hard to see how the case would not be substantially justified.
Well, thank you. I would agree with that.
What are we looking at under an abuse of discretion standard?
For the attorney's fees matter and the bill of costs matter.
What about costs? What about costs? In the question on attorney's fees, whether or not the government is substantially justified in their position?
Correct.
Does that same standard apply to costs?
I believe the award of cost by the district court, by the clerk's office, is discretionary in and of
itself. No, that's not my question to you. I'm asking, is it the same standard? In the standard for award of attorney's fees, whether or not the government was substantially justified in their position?
Yes.
That's not, that substantially justified standard doesn't apply to cost, or does it?
For the bill of cost?
Yes.
Yes. Right. It's a discretionary, with the district court.
I'm not asking if it's discretionary or not. I'm just saying that for a prevailing party to get calls, they have to show that the other side was not substantially justified in bringing their action.
No, they do not. They just
that's just what I asked you.
Yes.
What? What are you telling me? Seems to me that isn't this correct? For the award of attorney's fees, we look at what the judge did under an abuse of discretion standard.
Correct.
And the standard he applies there is whether or not the government's claim was substantially justified. Is that correct?
Correct.
So we look to his finding that it was substantially justified and see if he abused his discretion in making that finding, correct?
Correct.
That's not how you decide cost, is it?
No, it's not. It's still an abuse of discretion standard.
Right.
But the underlying standard with the trial court is just the discretion of the trial court in awarding costs, as opposed to
So what do we take from the point to me what the district court said to let us know that it wasn't an abuse of discretion to deny costs?
Right, the $3,000 or $4,000 in costs.
Right.
Well,
I don't even know. I'm not sure the exact amount.
Right, but it's not nearly as close. As you know, large.
So what do you point to let me know that it wasn't an abuse of discretion on cost? To let me know that the judge didn't sort of lump them all together and use the substantially justified standard for both?
Well, first of all, the reimbursing of with respect to the prevailing party must in fact be incurred by that party. And I believe it was clear from the record that Mrs. Rachel did not incur any of the costs.
But the judge said.
I cannot recall whether he melded those two issues for purposes of examination, but we certainly asserted that she did not incur any costs associated with her claim.
I'm just wondering, can you point me to anything, not what you think? You do answer that for me. Did the judge specifically say something that I could look at for me to be comfortable that it wasn't an abuse of discretion or just denial of call, not attorney's fees, but call? Can you point me to something? There may be. I'm not saying there is.
And I will admit that the opinion maybe did not dissect those issues as carefully as it should have.
So my point is, you don't really want to. You can't. I'm not saying it's not there, but I'm just asking. You can't point me to anything right off. All right. So let's go to B. You tell me why it wasn't an abuse of discretion on the call. I think that's where you hit.
That first head. Yes, sir. Well, first of all, we know the procedural history. The denial of summary judgment by the trial court as to Mrs. Rachel's claim, the grant of summary judgment for the government's claim, the appearance before this court where the court reversed the grant of judgment, summary judgment as to Mrs. Rachel, declaring in essence that there was an issue of triable fact. So when you look at these in a totality, as the courts have done in Pierce and other cases, the government...
But she would have no cause. Seems to me you just make a pretty good claim that she would have some cause. It would have some cost and all that, wouldn't she? Or somebody just doing it for her for free? I mean, not attorney's fees, the cost. You haven't told me anything yet to make me think that she did not have cost.
Well, when we go back and look at the bill of costs, all of those costs were associated with the defense of the companies. You know, the deposition transcripts, I recall specifically, one of the costs was subpoena fees with respect to witnesses who testified about the pricing of this repair on another contract. Things again.
So is your argument then that looking at the bill of costs, you can't separate out anything, or the district court couldn't separate out anything that just went to her defense and it went to the defense of the company? Is that your argument? I don't want to belabor this too much, because you didn't really seem to address it. And I'm just asking you to address it for me right now.
Well, again, yes, these costs that were claimed, and they're delineated in the record, the actual costs that were claimed in the bill of costs, all are associated with the defense of the company and Mr. Rachel. If the defense as to Mrs. Rachel is not whether the pricing was justified, but just an innocent spouse defense, none of those costs appear to be associated with that defense. You know, it's difficult to parse out because you have one set of costs and you have four defendants, but when you look at them individually.
I'll let you go on something.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. But with respect to the EJIA fees and the substantial justification of the action, I think the record before the court last time was different but smaller in terms of Mrs. Rachel's culpability. The court well noted, and I believe it's on page 25, that Mrs. Rachel, we allege, signed these incorporation papers. They were notarized. I think it's 2025 and 2026, may be wrong. Notarized by, 2120 and 2121, notarized by her. The bank accounts for this company, CSM, the middleman company, listed with the bank at a PO office, yet they're sent to the home. The number of checks that we alleged Mrs. Rachel wrote out of that account, and we alleged at trial that this account was not operated like a business. It was a personal checking account for the family, and a lot of family-related expenses were paid from that account.
From and, the CSM account.
Correct, sir. And they appeared, those checks, many of them appeared to be signed by Mrs. Rachel. Now, there was testimony at trial that, in fact, Mr. Rachel, for whatever reason, often mimicked his wife's handwriting or what have you, and that's a question for the jury.
What was your evidence that that was her signature? At, for instance, at 2121 on the resolution.
Is that the?
That's the one you referenced to me. I just went to look at it. But what evidence did you have to base an argument to the jury on that she had signed? She just.
Your Honor, I miscited the records. 64 and 65 is where I wanted to go.
But she did sign on 2121 too. But
yes.
When her signature appeared in a place that you thought would indicate she was responsible and liable, what testimony did you have, did you put in front of the jury, that was her signature?
With 2164 and 65, which is the Articles of Incorporation, they're signed by a notary who you have to appear before a notary for the signature. And you look at her signature on that document, or the signature purporting to be her signature at 2064, it's significantly different than her husband's purported signature. And that signature and that handwriting appeared on many of these checks. So, the question was asked, is this her signature?
The signature on the Articles of Incorporation was notarized.
Yes, sir.
So she would have appeared before a notary public.
I believe so.
Of course, she denied all the checks. She denied that was her signature. She denied she went was in front of a notary. She didn't
Correct.
Know anything about anything, and there was no other handwriting analysis except what you did in court on the Elmo.
No, sir. Okay. Yes, you're correct. So it was a jury question to decide whether to believe that testimony, accept it or reject it. I use the term believe it, but accept it or reject it for liability purposes. In addition, we presented evidence regarding Mrs. Rachel's operation of another company called CSEI, and this was a company similar to CSM, which was created as a buffer, if you will, between the FAA and RGI. And we showed to the jury how the same, same set of operative events occurred there, where this company, TDR, actually did the work for, let's say, $30. CSEI this time gets the invoice, marks it up to a much higher amount, and then sells it, if you will, to RGI.
What's her role in CSEI?
I believe she actually signed contracts on their behalf, that she was an officer of that company and, in fact, signed contracts. And I think Mr. Tolchin is correct in stating that after Mr. Rachel was debarred, Mrs. Rachel took over RGI as an operator. I can't remember what her title was. But again, we argued to the jury that at that point in time, knowing full well that all of these events had occurred, she didn't make any of it right, which I think underscores her deliberate indifference, her complicity in the overall scheme. So going back, we're not relitigating the jury's findings here, but I think there was substantial evidence presented to the jury as to Mrs. Rachel's complicity, and I think Judge Nickerson was wholly justified under, quite frankly, any standard in denying the attorney's fees position. But going on to arguments presented as to Mr. Rachel and the companies, I think we have to remember, I look back at the briefs, and there's a difference between evidence and what a jury finds to be fact. And when we look at my opposing counsel's brief, it's quite frankly a statement of what he had hoped the jury might believe based upon snippets of information presented to it in or out of context. The whole argument here is the underpinnings of it is that there was no contract between RGI and DSMI, the prime contractor, that RGI was a mere supplier of some kit, a part, and therefore it could charge whatever it wanted.
It's a fairly routine tactic in a civil trial for the parties to try to get favorable pieces of evidence from their side embodied in instruction, and as well to get proposed jury findings smuggled into instructions. They don't. Each side is not entirely content with a neutral statement of the law. They want the evidence favorable to them pointed out in instructions, and they want the way that they hope the jury to go to be all but foreordained in the instructions. They want to tilt the game board and have the instructions winking and nodding in their direction. Trial judges don't abuse their discretion in not going along with that with that kind of thing. The whole question is, do you give each party a fair chance to argue its case under the legal principles that's framed at a rather general level? And that happened here. There was plenty of room for everybody to argue whether it was fraud or whether this was a legitimate way of doing business. That was the whole question. You don't want to load up the instructions to prejudge the case for the jury.
I would agree wholeheartedly. Mr. Tolchin was an honorable and forceful advocate for his clients. Every piece of evidence presented, he argued in a light, in a way that...
But he argued forcefully and rightfully so.
Absolutely.
That this was just business, and that this was, that this was just a profit-making enterprise, and that's a perfectly legitimate kind of thing.
And we argued the opposite, and I believe the jury rejected his view of the events, or his advocacy of the view of the events, and found in favor of the government. And with respect to the jury instruction, certainly I'm very familiar with the Wilson KBR case. That was unique, somewhat unique set of circumstances where the basis of the claim, if you will, was some sort of nebulous requirement that quote, vehicles be maintained, as opposed to something more specific and concrete. And I think had the circumstances been different here, perhaps a Wilson-like instruction may have been, it may have been appropriate to weave something like that into the instructions, but there was no need to do that in this matter. And I believe the jury was fully and accurately apprised of the law. And most curiously, I don't believe we have a full set of actual jury instructions before this court. So I think it's rather difficult to discern the actual words used to instruct a jury when that has not been presented. So I think that underscores the strength or lack thereof of this particular argument with respect to the jury instruction. So with that, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
To address a few of the matters that counsel raised. Counsel kept referring to pages 2064 and 2065 of the record as proof of Mrs. Rachel's involvement, given that there was a notarization of her signature. The evidence presented at trial, and it's in the record before the court, was that Mr. Rachel said that the notary worked for him and he directed that she sign this, and she did. Mrs. Rachel said that's not her signature. Mr. Rachel said that is his rendition of the signature. But most importantly, the third signature on there, Jeffrey Rachel, is Mr. Rachel's son, and he at the time was about 16 years old at the time this was signed. And Jeffrey Rachel, who is a police officer now, appeared in court 10 years later when we had the trial and said, that's not my signature.
You're looking at all this through hindsight, but the point is that what you're recounting, it doesn't make the government's case not substantially justified. I mean, it would be hard for me to see how we could reverse somebody who sat through a trial under an abuse of discretion standard, say the government's case was not substantially justified when she's an officer and director of the corporation that is falsifying and inflating the invoices, and when she's a spouse of a person, and when her signature is on it with a notarized form. The whole point is the government doesn't have to win the case, but you can't take every case the government loses and then go back with 20/20 hindsight and say it wasn't justified to bring the case to begin with. The previous panel felt the whole thing was close. It sent the whole thing back for a trial. Judge Shedd pointed out it didn't grant Mrs. Rachel summary judgment. It didn't suggest that she should be granted summary judgment. Four of these defendants were found liable. It's not justified to think that the fifth was hooked in with them, given the evidence that was there.
Yes.
I mean, under the government can bring these cases. And every time we get an EAJA case up on appeal, it's almost like the government didn't win. Its case must have been totally without merit.
Except in this case, Your Honor, we have a different issue. This is the quintessential innocent spouse case. This is the quintessential situation in which one spouse signs things for the other spouse.
It was close enough to present a jury question. I looked at this case with some care. I thought Mrs. Rachel was lucky, really lucky. But probably a testament to your fine lawyer, and a good one too, because it's exactly what a good advocate does. But it was close. It was close.
Your Honor,
is your argument that a properly notarized statement cannot stand as evidence in a court of law? That has to be your argument, isn't
it? No, my argument is that if the government is going to charge Mrs. Rachel
you have to answer my question. I want to just focus on that notarized statement, mm-hmm. that she signed that document, and then they could look at her signature there and other places that she signed. Your argument, I think, must rest on the fact that a properly notarized statement is not admissible and usable evidence.
No, my argument does not rise to fall on that.
So in other words, then the jury can believe that she did sign that document based on that proper notarization.
Again, my argument does not rise to fall.
No, but you have to answer my question. Could the jury believe that that is Priscilla Rachel's signature at page 2064 because it was properly notarized? Could the jury believe that?
Yes, but the jury should never have seen this document if the government were doing its job properly. Because the government had...
Did the jury see it?
Yes, because...
So then the jury could have. You may not have wanted them to, but they could have found that that is her signature on page 2064 based on that document.
Right.
Now, you can argue what else they could have drawn from that.
Yes, but the issue here is not whether the jury could have believed it. The issue in my mind under EJA is whether the government should have looked at this, asked the question,
When you argued at first, I thought you and I had a discussion. You said there was no evidence that she'd signed.
No evidence that she signed this.
It's notarized.
Well,
you just told me that could stand as evidence. That's what you just told me.
It is notarized, but...
No, I didn't ask you if it was notarized.
Okay, was there any
evidence? Okay. No, I asked you, could that stand? Could the jury use that to believe that she signed it based on that notary? And you said yes.
Right, but the issue here is substantial, not any. Substantial evidence. And if the government had done its job properly, because the government has an obligation when it charges its citizens for fraud to do a good job before it charges them. And had it done that job, it would have happened.
Did you ever ask for costs for her, not attorney's fees, but costs?
Yes.
Is there somewhere in the record where I can see what those costs are?
There's a bill cost. I'm not sure if the bill cost is in this record, but the bill cost is we presented a bill cost and the judge denied it.
Well,
in the same opinion saying we deny cost and we deny cost.
Did he ever
fees.
Talk about cost?
No, all? Other than denying it.
His order that I see, he addressed the substantially justified argument as far as
just put them both together. Put them both together and deny them all.
Tell me in 15 seconds why you think you should. Why are you entitled to cost here? Is there an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, there is an abuse of discretion.
And how do we know that how do you argue he abused his discretion?
He didn't address it at all. He said he's denying costs on the basis of substantial justification.
And you're telling me he didn't address it anywhere else that you're aware of other than that one order?
That's right.
That is
correct.
Are those separate costs from the other three defendants, or are they all lumped together?
They are all lumped together. And here's the problem. If you're going to charge Mrs. Rachel with saying that she could be liable because she's associated with these people, then her costs are the same associated costs. And what happened here is that she owned RGI. She was the 100% owner and the president. And what she did is she had the payments being written by RGI since it was her company, and RGI paid everybody's costs. But it was her money. If it didn't, RGI didn't pay, it would come to her as her money. So that's clearly, she's associated, she gets her costs. And that's the answer. I think I'm out of time right now, so.
We'll come down, Greek Council, moving to our next event.